Welcome to this episode of the PER On Air Optometry Times podcast. Today's topic is reimagining dry eye disease, delineating the role of evaporation from inflammation, and insights into optimizing treatment. A newer definition of dry eye disease from the Tifos-Dews workshop is that it's a multifactorial disease of the ocular surface characterized by a loss of homeostasis of the tear film and accompanied by ocular symptoms in which tear film instability and hyperosmolarity, ocular surface inflammation and damage, and neurosensory abnormalities play etiological roles. Or, in other words, it's initiated by desiccating stress and perpetuated by a vicious circle of ocular surface inflammation. In this podcast, you'll hear from a panel of experts who shared insights into targetable contributors to dry eye, continuing a conversation they started at a live program held earlier in 2024. First up, optometrist Justin Schweitzer takes a closer look at the components of this vicious cycle.
Yeah, we know that dry eye does have multiple mechanisms to it. And when we look at this vicious cycle that occurs, we know it's aqueous deficient combined with evaporative. Sometimes it's aqueous deficient alone. Sometimes it's evaporative alone. But the majority of the time when we're seeing these patients, it's a combination of the two. And then on top of that, well, how does that occur? Well, it occurs from a lot of outside factors that play a role. Patients that have autoimmune disorders, contact lens wears, patients that have ocular surgeries that have been done, allergies. I'm going to leave a bunch of other ones out, but there's such a variety of environmental factors that can play a role. And the issue is if this vicious cycle continues to occur and you continue to have evaporative, dry, aqueous deficient, going over and over again, and we don't break that cycle, then these patients are going to continue to suffer. There's a really good reference that was published in Ocular Surface in 2013 that has a great pictorial and great image of what this vicious cycle looks like. And it has all these different etiologies that I mentioned that contribute to it and gives you ideas around, well, how do we break that vicious cycle that's occurring for our patients with ocular surface disease and dry eye?
Next, optometrist Jade Coates expands on images she shared at the live event that illustrated different patterns of staining that suggest contributors to individual patients' dry eye. And Dr. Schweitzer comments on testing for markers of inflammation in patients with signs and symptoms of an inflammatory component to their dry eye.
Whenever we stain, again, staining is very clinically relevant. It's very affordable for our patients and practitioners too. So simply starting with the fluorescein staining can identify a lot. In clinic, for me, whenever I see bilateral or unilateral staining, and depending on where it's located, really can tailor my treatment plan. For example, if I were to find bilateral corneal staining that's very interpalpebral with maybe symptoms worse in the morning, that might clue me into maybe that patient's kind of sleeping with their eyes cracked at night. Or it may help me dive deeper into, tell me what your nighttime activities look like. Do you sleep with an overhead ceiling fan? Are you sleeping with a CPAP? Is there some sort of environmental factor that's further worsening this bilateral corneal staining? In a different example, if I were to find maybe a younger individual with unilateral staining and maybe just kind of nasally, I would maybe dive deeper. Same thing. Are you a side sleeper? Are you a stomach sleeper? Is there anything that you do that you're aware of during your sleep habits that might further worsen this problem? Interestingly, the unilateral patients, the patients with maybe unilateral staining and sometimes first thing in the morning nasally are our side sleepers or are our stomach sleepers. And so helping to identify the culprit or just educating them that maybe they might sleep with an eye that's cracked, and knowing that little detail can really impact our dry eye treatment. Other clinical stainings, for example, if we were to see diffuse SBK, that particular staining pattern might clue us into something a little bit different. So dry eye disease is unfortunately very multifactorial, and there's an evaporative component, there's aqueous deficient component, and all of the different staining patterns may kind of clue you into whether it's one, the other, or oftentimes, unfortunately, both.
So the most important testing for me when I'm looking for inflammation on my patients is our vital dyes. Our sodium fluorescein, lissamine green, they could tell us so much, and it's such a simple, easy, quick test to do. If I see corneal staining, I know there's inflammation present. Now, is it always from dry eye? No, but I see corneal staining. I know that there's inflammation present. If I see lissamine green staining, that raises a suspicion that this patient may have a potential autoimmune type of disorder that's creating some of that staining. And so our vital dyes are essential. We should be using these on all our patients when we're looking for ocular surfaces or dry eye, and specifically inflammation. I do love using in-office technologies like MMP9 testing. It's confirmatory a lot of times, and it's a great educational tool for your patients as well. You're able to show them the result and talk through it with them. Once I have these results, we have great treatment options and we should embrace these. We have immunomodulators to manage inflammation. We have topical corticosteroids that can manage inflammation and really make a big impact for our patients with this inflammatory component of dry eye.
Dr. Schweitzer was asked to comment on the biggest unmet needs in managing patients with dry eye disease, which led to a discussion on the range of opportunities that are also available.
Honestly, we have all the diagnostic tools and all the treatment tools right now in our arsenal to manage a lot of our patients with their evaporative dry eye. We think about from the diagnosis standpoint, using some type of ocular surface disease questionnaire beforehand to identify our symptomatic patients. That's available to us. A slit lamp, we all have that. Our vital dyes to look for staining, we have that. And then some type of instrument to either image the meibomian glands to be able to identify gland structure problems, or if you don't have that technology, just pressing on the glands with a digit, you're able to evaluate the meibom and how it's functioning in that regard. So we have the tools to be able to diagnose these patients. There's advanced tools as well. And then we have treatment options available as well. We have immunomodulators to deal with inflammation. We have steroids to deal with inflammation. On the evaporative side, we have new medications, perfluorohexoctane, that have come onto the market. We have in-office therapies like thermal pulsation, heating and expressing of the gland, even intense pulse light available to manage that evaporative component. But per the question we just talked about, what is really the unmet need? The unmet need is really us as doctors, we have to embrace these technologies. We have to diagnose, we have to want to use these technologies to manage our patients, because there are tons of patients out there with dry eye. But if us as doctors don't care about it, if we don't feel like it's a major problem, then we're never going to use the diagnostic technology we have available. And we're never going to use all these great technologies to treat these patients to provide the help that these patients really need.
And finally, Dr. Coates discusses how she has incorporated newer therapies for dry eye disease into her practice. And optometrist Cecilia Ketting provides insights into how she uses cyclosporin and lifitegrast to treat inflammatory dry eye.
So in practice, we have great success with incorporating newer products by really dosing in the chair. Some patients with dry eye have tried many, many products, and they might have discontinued for whatever reason, such as burning or stinging, or really not being educated properly on the potential common side effects. And so for us in office, for example, perfluorohexaloctane, sometimes these patients, again, they have discontinued previous products from burning and stinging. And so in office, we have been dosing it in the chair, and the feedback has been really great, because instantly they can tell that it's not going to burn or sting in most cases. And so what this does is it allows the patient to have hope before they even get the eye drop. And I think that this really does help with compliance by dosing, just giving them a little dose in the chair. Same thing with varenicline. Part of the success with newer therapies is educating the patient so that they really understand what they're doing. And especially with varenicline, you have to use it properly. And it's way easier than maybe some people even realize. There's no inhaling that needs to really be done. It's just the spraying of the varenicline. And so what we do, what we have great success with, is dosing that and educating patients in the chair that there is a chance that they might sneeze, and we're here for them. So we have to offer them a tissue. And once they know that that's normal and kind of expected, again, they realize, well, wow, my eyes do feel really much better with this. And knowing that that might happen, they might be more acceptable to the treatment plan and not discontinue so quickly.
So when we're talking about fitting in our lifitegrast and cyclosporin into our treatment, those also are inflammatory controlling medications similar to our steroid, but right, we aren't going to use a steroid long-term. We can use those, and we don't have the same side effect profile as we do from using chronic long-term steroids. And so with both lifitegrast and cyclosporin, those are my patients who have more chronic problems. Thinking about my autoimmune patients, my Sjogren's, my rheumatoid, my lupus, people who are going to have chronic long-term. But also remember, it's not just those patients, it's anybody who has aqueous deficiency, because the lifitegrast and cyclosporin are going to help with production of more tears, better quality tears, as well as calming down that inflammation on all our long-term treatments. And when do I pick one versus the other? Well, with cyclosporin, we've got a number of options at this point. We have a 0.05%, we have a 0.09%, and a 0.1%. And they all are a little bit different. More recently, the 0.1%, which is in, it's actually, vehicle is perfluoropentylbutane. I believe I said that one correctly. And that actually helps to retain it on the front surface longer. So they're showing that it actually can stay on the surface for up to 30 minutes, which means better penetration in theory. I will say that I am noticing patients consistent with the studies within 2 weeks, having an improvement in signs and symptoms by 2 weeks of use. So that's actually really encouraging. Overall side effect profile has been pretty good. A couple of patients have said it stings a little bit, but can't honestly tell you somebody who doesn't say that there's not a little stinging with any one of them. So that's been a nice addition recently. Now, historically, we also have our 0.05%, which is our OG and our generic as well. And that still is very useful. And sometimes that is the only one that insurance will cover. So if that is kind of your where we can go with it. It still works, right? And you can, don't be afraid to increase it from BID, which is the on-label dosage. You can increase. I do have patients where I use it 3 times a day. And then also we have the 0.09%, which is double the strength of the original, and also shows symptoms and signs improving within as little as, I believe it's 2 to 4 weeks. Versus we know the original, we're looking at almost 3 months, right? And then finally, don't forget lifitegrast. Lifitegrast works different than cyclosporin. And so there are times I call them cousins, right? Because they kind of work in the same area, but where cyclosporin works only on active inflammatory, like the active inflammation, the lifitegrast works on inactive and active, right? So we and you know, they're working differently. And that's why some people, one will work better for someone versus another. So don't be afraid that if they're not responding to one category, to jump over to the other and try it, because we are so lucky in 2024, whenever you're watching this, maybe 2025, to have all of these things in our bag of tricks to be able to treat our patients. So don't forget that, you know, keep trying, keep trucking. You got lots of different percentages at this point, even a different, you know, vehicle. And we also have with the cyclosporins, and now we also have the lifitegrast that is also very helpful in these patients as well.
Thank you for joining us for this PER On Air Optometry Times podcast.